The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today, we're reading from the September 5th, September 12th issue of the Week. And we are in our second reading of the September 5th, September 12th Labor Day issue of the Week. Read the main stories and a bit more of the current news last week. We'll go a little deeper this week with some of our regular items and a few extra. So we'll start today with the briefing. Jeffrey Epstein's secrets. 6 years after his death, conspiracy theories still swirl around the sex trafficker. Why? What explains the fascination with Epstein? It's a combination of factors. There's the horrific nature of his crimes, his collection of famous friends, and the unanswered questions about how his abuse went unpunished for so long. The financier, who died by suicide in a jail cell in 2019 while awaiting trial on sex trafficking charges, left a $578 million estate that included a palatial Manhattan townhouse, a mansion in Palm Beach, Florida, and a private Caribbean island. Court documents detail how he trafficked girls as young as 11 to those properties and held them there in sexual servitude. Since Epstein's social circle included Britain's Prince Andrew, Microsoft co-founder Bill Gates, former President Bill Clinton, and now President Trump, all of whom deny any wrongdoing, the case remains catnip for conspiracy theorists, many of whom believe the government is hiding a list of Epstein pedophile clients. But it isn't only cranks who think the public hasn't been told the full story. This was a man that was allowed to abuse girls and women for two decades, said the Miami Herald journalist Julie K. Brown, whose reporting led the Epstein case to be reopened in 2018. The victims deserve to know whether our government did the job they were supposed to do. How did he get so wealthy? It's not completely clear. Born to working-class parents in Brooklyn, Epstein never graduated from college, but was hired by New York's prestigious Dalton Prep School, where he taught math and physics from 1974 to 76. He was fired for poor performance, but not before impressing Dalton parent and Bear Stearns CEO Ace Greenberg, who hired him at the investment bank. Epstein founded his own money management firm in 1981, but it was never a major Wall Street player. Various theories have circulated about the source of his riches, including that Epstein might have blackmailed influential people by collecting footage of them having sex with underage girls. What is known is that most of Epstein's money came from two clients, Victoria's Secret owner Leslie Wexler and private equity mega investor Leon Black, who together paid him a hefty $370 million in fees. Both Wexner and Black say they regret their ties with Epstein and deny any wrongdoing. Who else did he associate with? Epstein cultivated friendships with politicians, business leaders, and celebrities. Many of them, including Clinton, Trump, and Gates, flew on Epstein's private plane, later nicknamed the Lolita Express. Woody Allen, former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak, and magician David Copperfield met repeatedly with Epstein. Trump and Epstein socialized frequently from the 1980s to the early 2000s, and in 2002, Trump told New York Magazine that the terrific Epstein likes beautiful women as much as I do, and many of them are on the younger side. Their friendship ended in 2004 amid a bidding war over a Palm Beach mansion. Trump recently claimed the two fell out over after Epstein stole young women who worked at his Mar-a-Lago club. One employee was Virginia Jeffrey, who said she was groomed in 2000 at age 16 by Epstein's partner, Ghislaine Maxwell. When did the abuse start? At Maxwell's 2021 sex trafficking trial, a woman identified only as Kate testified that Maxwell befriended her at 17 in 1994, promising to help her musical career. Maxwell pushed Kate to give Epstein massages that soon turned sexual and told her to recruit other cute girls. The Justice Department's sex trafficking case, which focused on the early 2000s, detailed how Epstein entrapped scores of underage victims, mainly from broken homes, with the promise of modeling careers or other work. Courtney Wilde, groomed by Epstein at 14, said she recruited 70 to 80 girls who were all 14 and 15 years old for the financier. Jeffrey, who died by suicide in April, said she was passed around like a platter of fruit and forced to have sex with Epstein associates such as Prince Andrew. He denies the accusation. Much of the predation took place at Epstein's island. According to one lawsuit, a 15-year-old victim tried to swim away from the island. She was caught by his crew and had her passport confiscated. When did law enforcement get involved? In 2005, the stepmother of a 14-year-old told Palm Beach police that the financier had sexually assaulted the teen. An investigation uncovered many more victims but produced an infamous 2008 sweetheart deal. Epstein received an 18-month sentence for soliciting prostitution in exchange for the shuttering of an FBI probe and immunity for any potential co-conspirators. He had a prison wing to himself and was chauffeured 6 days a week to his West Palm Beach office before being released 5 months early. He abused more girls during and after his sentence, according to lawsuits. It took a 2018 Miami Herald expose to stir a national outcry. Then Trump Labor Secretary Alexander Acosta, who had helped broker the 2008 deal as a federal prosecutor, resigned. And Epstein was arrested on federal sex trafficking charges in July 2019. Weeks later, Epstein, 66, was found dead in a Manhattan jail cell with a bedsheet around his neck. Is there much we still don't know about Epstein? The full scope of his abuse and who else sexually exploited the girls is still a mystery. On the campaign trail last year, Trump pledged to release all the DOJ's investigative files on Epstein, and in February, Attorney General Pam Bondi claimed to have Epstein's client list on her desk. But in July, the Justice Department stated that the list didn't exist, that Epstein was not, as conspiracy theorists claimed, assassinated, and that it wouldn't publicly release the Epstein files. Trump's name, the Wall Street Journal later reported, appears multiple times in the documents. The president has urged his supporters to move on from the pretty boring case. Many of Epstein's victims say they feel re-traumatized by the administration's promotion and then dismissal of the scandal. All the work that we did to tell the world what happened to us, said Danielle Binsky, who was recruited by Epstein at 17, it's all being erased. A twisted partnership. In late 1991, Ghislaine Maxwell was in a jam. Her father, British media baron Robert Maxwell, had drowned in a yachting accident, and authorities had discovered he'd embezzled some $580 million from his company's pension funds. Ghislaine, recently arrived in Manhattan, was forced to downsize from a large apartment to a cramped studio. Epstein, whom she'd met that summer, came to her rescue. He lavished her with more than $30 million over the years, and she became his devoted girlfriend. She was also there to recruit, molest, and pressure Epstein's underage victims to do his bidding. This was very much a joint effort, said Epstein victim Sarah Ransom. Maxwell was sentenced to 20 years in prison for sex trafficking in 2022. She is now seeking a pardon from Trump. The girls she groomed, said prosecutor Laura Pomerantz, were just a means to support her lifestyle. And we'll pick up a few of the columns that we missed last week. A couple of international columns, first from Japan. When the state tries to play matchmaker, picture it, said Waka Ikeda, a room full of clipboard-wielding bureaucrats earnestly facilitating romance for a handful of single 20-somethings. That was the scene at a recent government-led matching event that was so poorly attended, the matchmakers outnumbered the daters. Japan's crippling low birth rate has prompted the government to attempt a slew of such interventions, creating a state-sanctioned dating app and holding official speed dating events and marriage seminars. It's both heavy-handed and entirely unnecessary. The problem isn't that Japanese singletons don't have chances to meet and fall in love. It's that Japanese culture pushes traditional 20th century family models while failing to support young people's economic independence. Young women simply don't want to stay home and raise children while their husband works extreme hours and doesn't help at all with housework or childcare. And while local governments may claim to be promoting gender equality and diverse lifestyles, in practice, Japanese companies give men high-powered careers and funnel women into pink ghetto jobs. We need to stop treating the demographic crisis as a dating and women's fertility problem and start recognizing it as a structural economic issue. Both men and women need jobs with work-life balance. Then, just maybe, women will start having those babies. Sri Lanka. Destination of choice for Israelis. Sri Lankans are getting fed up with the visible and growing Israeli footprint in the popular surfing town of Arugam Bay, said Rathindra Kuruwita. Downtown walls are plastered with stickers and posters in Hebrew, far outnumbering those written in Sinhala, Tamil, or English. One Australian blogger said he wondered if he was in Tel Aviv. When our country reopened to tourists in 2022, after the pandemic pause, the government tried to boost tourism by inviting an Israeli film crew to shoot a movie. Arugam Bay, about a group of surfers in the same Israeli military unit who come to Sri Lanka to heal their trauma, was a hit, and Israelis began flocking to the town. They quickly set up illegal expat firms, including surf schools, photography schools, yoga schools, and so on, siphoning business from the locals. Worse, they tended to bring in illegal Israeli workers to do the construction and run their operations. Angry Sri Lankans want the government to crack down on those rogue expats. But Israel's leverage runs through Washington. If Sri Lanka were to punish the Israeli interlopers, the U.S. could punish it in turn through tariffs or travel warnings. As long as Sri Lanka is dependent on tourism, it is stuck with Israelis who are not just holidaying, but operating outside the rules. Ireland. The downside of hosting U.S. tech firms. American tech money has warped Ireland's economy, said David McWilliams. Ireland lured tech giants Apple, Google, Meta, and Microsoft to put their European bases of operations here, offering ultra-low corporate taxes and an English-speaking talent pool. The result was an economic boom. These multinationals are akin to a resource find, a spigot that churns out tax revenue. But as any country that strikes oil soon learns, it's dangerous to rely so much on one bonanza industry. because there is so much money gushing out of the multinationals and going directly into the public sector, spending in that sector soars. Special interest groups with big lobbying arms rush to grab as much as they can, and they grow too powerful. It's called Dutch disease, after what happened to the Netherlands when it found natural gas in the North Sea in the late 1960s. Wages in the booming gas sector pulled up wages elsewhere, and housing prices shot up as newly rich oil workers could afford more. As the currency appreciated, other sectors besides gas found it hard to export, and they atrophied. The same is happening here, where the government has become a reckless spender of American money. What if corporate America changes its policies? How would we adapt? Dutch disease can prove fatal to an economy, and Ireland doesn't seem to have figured out a vaccine. And we'll spend a little time today with short pieces from technology and health and science. The technology page has a small box called Bytes, What's New in Tech? That's B-Y-T-E-S. And we'll read a couple of those short pieces. Big Tech's power surge. One tangible impact of artificial intelligence is its insatiable demand for electricity, said Ivan Penn and Karen Weiss in the New York Times. Large rectangular buildings packed with servers consumed more than 4% of the nation's electricity in 2023, and government analysts estimate that will increase to as much as 12% in just 3 years. Data centers require expensive upgrades to the electrical grid, costs that will be shared with residents and smaller businesses unless tech companies are forced to cover expenses. Electrical rates, already rising sharply, could be turbocharged. In Ohio, the bill for a typical household increased at least $15 a month because of data centers, according to a utility and grid monitor. Lawmakers worry that if AI boom fizzles, residents and smaller businesses will be stuck paying for unused power. Soap operas for the phone age. Streaming apps that dole out drama in 60-second segments are beating the streaming giants in user growth, said Tatum Hunter in the Washington Post. So-called vertical streaming apps peddling soap opera-like shorts shot vertically a la TikTok are gaining enormous traction. One popular app, DramaBox, averaged 44 million monthly active users during the first half of 2025. More than Hulu or Paramount Plus. Fans are discovering the shorts on TikTok or Facebook, where streaming companies post clips or trailers to lure viewers to their apps. Some of the most popular series, like Secret Surrogate to the Mafia King and Pregnant by My Ex's Professor Dad, use sensational plots, over-the-top acting, and sexy power dynamics to keep viewers hooked. It is an expensive habit for fans. Many of the apps charge $20 a week to subscribe versus an ad-free Netflix subscription of $17.99 a month. And on the health and science page, turning a star inside out. Stars are believed to form in stratified layers, like an onion, with lighter elements such as hydrogen and helium on the outside, increasingly heavier chemicals like carbon, magnesium, and sulfur beneath, and iron at the core. Astronomers have never seen those layers, though, because when a star goes supernova, all the elements are expelled at once. Now, for the first time, they have. In supernova 2021 YFJ, observed at the Palomar Observatory in San Diego, the star had already shed its outer layers, and only the iron core was left to explode. This supernova was unlike anything we had seen, astronomer Steve Schultz tells the New York Times. We had no idea it's possible to strip a star to this extreme amount. It's unclear what caused the star to lose the layers, possibly stellar winds or internal eruptions, but the process likely took thousands of years. The scientists were able to observe the very moment when the core exploded, lighting up a previously expelled stellar layer of silicon, sulfur, and argon. They estimate that 1 in 1,000 stars may undergo such stripping, but it isn't apparent unless you look very closely at the light signatures. There was a lot of luck involved in making this discovery, Schultz said. This brain implant hears thoughts. Scientists at Stanford University have developed a pioneering brain implant that can detect and decode the thoughts of people with vocal paralysis. Researchers have previously succeeded in using implanted brain-computer interfaces to decode words when the subjects are attempting to speak them, when they are moving their mouths, tongues, and vocal cords. Now they are able to interpret signals in the brain's motor cortex without the subject doing any physical movement. This is the first time we've managed to understand what brain activity looks like when you just think about speaking, electrical engineer Aaron Kuntz tells the Financial Times. In the new study, 4 severely paralyzed participants were asked to either attempt to speak or to silently imagine a set of words. The signals resulting from just thinking about the words were weaker, but with one subject, the interface accurately interpreted the signals about 75% of the time. It's not yet good enough to allow people to hold conversations with just their minds, but it's a sign that it might someday be possible, says Kuntz. We haven't hit the ceiling yet. Is malaria back in the U.S.? Malaria is beginning to pop up in the U.S. among people who didn't travel abroad, which indicates that it is once again spreading in homegrown mosquito populations. Each year, around 2,000 travelers come back to the U.S. with cases of debilitating disease acquired abroad, but this summer, one person in Washington State and another in New Jersey appear to have contracted it stateside. Malaria was once common in the U.S. George Washington famously suffered multiple bouts of the disease, but was effectively eliminated by 1951, thanks to a widespread campaign of pesticide use and the drainage of breeding sites. Now that climate change has made winters too short to kill off the Anopheles mosquito that carry it, domestic cases appear to be rising. It's all probabilities, malaria researcher Fotini Sinis of Johns Hopkins University tells Scientific American, and warmer winters just will increase those probabilities. In adults, malaria typically causes fatigue, chills, and other flu-like symptoms that can recur after years. In young children, it's much more dangerous and can cause seizures and death. This is called the Making Money page. We've got an article and a couple of short things. Housing costs. Is deregulation the answer? A flourishing Washington, D.C. neighborhood has seen an explosion of apartment building that may offer lessons to how to address the nation's housing crisis, said The Economist. Once known as Swamp Poodle and now called NoMa, the area a little north of the Capitol has added more new apartments units since 2017 than any other zip code in the U.S., according to data from Yardi, a real estate software company. Get off the Washington Metro there, and you'll be barraged by now leasing signs boasting rooftop pools, full-featured gyms, and one-month free rental offers. Prices in Washington aren't exactly cheap, but they are at least less exorbitant than East Coast peers like New York or Boston. The YIMBY, Y-I-M-B-Y, or Yes in My Backyard movement, wants to claim what's happening in D.C. as a victory, said Brian Shearer in the Washington Monthly. And indeed, the city is now building more housing per capita than Houston. But it hasn't done it through deregulation. The city created housing loans, built mass transit to create new neighborhoods, traded zoning exceptions for cheaper housing, and purchased and bundled lots to lease to developers for big projects. All this has happened without the policy changes that the YIMBY cohort keeps pushing. Perhaps surprisingly, the wide-ranging effort didn't include uniform citywide dezoning, upzoning, or permitting reform. That undersells the pro-housing movement, said Ron Davis in The Atlantic. It's not just about a specific set of regulations, but a populist movement that challenges vested interest. Progressives and other foes of market-rate housing want to write off the YIMBYs as conservatives, but there's nothing inherently conservative about a push to lower housing cost. In fact, the battle over zoning regulation doesn't follow traditional political lines at all, said Derek Thompson in his Substack newsletter. Look at Dallas. As the city has been built out, it has been burdened with more rules such as minimum lot size requirements that discourage smaller, cheaper housing. Predictably, home prices in Dallas have doubled. Texas NIMBYs now sound just like their California counterparts when you get them in a room with city councils. Just a jauntier twang. The bad news for just about everyone who thinks about housing is that interest rate cuts are not coming to homebuyers' rescue, said Sidney Lake in Fortune. Historically low mortgage rates during the pandemic, some below 3%, soared to more than 8% in late 2023 and still hover around 6.5%. Those high rates are a key facet of the housing affordability crisis. For a typical home to be affordable to the average buyer, rates need to drop to 4.43%, according to an analysis from Zillow, a decline that's currently unrealistic. And what the experts say. Wall Street welcomes you back. J.P. Morgan CEO Jamie Dimon was never a fan of work from home, and the bank's new headquarters serves as a 60-story exclamation mark, said Alice Tikotsky in Business Insider. With a gym, massive food hall, and 24/7 grab-and-go option, the building reinforces a long-standing law of Wall Street. Work and life are often indistinguishable. J.P. Morgan called nearly all workers back to the office full-time earlier this year. Don't give me the shit that work from home Fridays works, Dimon was heard saying in a town hall. I call a lot of people on Fridays, and there's not a person you can get a hold of. But what goes for Wall Street may not apply widely. While New York City office workers are going to offices at a higher rate than before the pandemic, office visits in other big cities still lag by 20 to 35%. A shrinking watchdog agency. While the crypto industry is booming, its federal oversight is not, said Lydia Bayou in Bloomberg Businessweek. Caroline Fan, the acting head of the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, has chopped senior managers and 15% of staff and discontinued a third of open investigations. Particularly hard hit is the Enforcement Division, which probed fraud such as Sam Bankman-Fried's FTX. Former agency staff and industry players describe an agency in disarray. While unlikely to generate the kind of public outrage that has met other Trump administration cuts, the CFTC's diminishment comes as crypto seeps into every corner of financial markets. And there's recent history to consider. When the financial system crashed in 2008, it was partly because of the growth of complex derivatives that have since been brought under CFTC oversight. This is one of the business columns. At Miracle-Gro, pot was no miracle. The weed business needs more than Miracle-Gro to return to its pandemic high, said Dean Seal. Jim Hagedorn, the chief executive of Scotts Miracle-Gro, attended dinner with President Trump at Mar-a-Lago in April, hoping to persuade the president to end the federal government's hostility toward legal cannabis. It might sound like a strange position for the head of a billion-dollar lawn and garden company, but Scotts has quietly been watering the weed industry since 2014, when Hagedorn formed a new subsidiary named Hawthorne Gardening Company to be a corporate trailblazer in the cannabis industry. Hawthorne initially cast its business as selling products for hydroponics or indoor gardening, but a wave of legalizations across dozens of states eventually emboldened Scotts to embrace its pot business publicly. When the pandemic triggered a boom in marijuana consumption, investors seized on Hawthorne as a one-stop supplier for weed growing, and Scotts shares soared. But the high didn't last. Sales fell back to earth in 2022, and wholesale prices tumbled. Many growers went bust, and Scotts' golden goose became an albatross. After investing $2 billion in Hawthorne, Scott is now looking to offload it by year's end. And the last word, our feature article, a political gamble. A Washington, D.C. lawyer wants more Americans to bet on elections and politics, said Nancy Scola in Washingtonian. Those wagers could result in better policymaking or a weaker democracy. It's a springtime Thursday night at Nanny O'Brien's Irish Pub in Northwest D.C., and up on the TVs, the University of Maryland's men's basketball team is struggling against the University of Florida. The bar is stuffed with revelers eating chicken wings and drinking beer. Given that Americans will wager an estimated $3.1 billion on college basketball's championship tournament this year, it's a fair bet that at least some of them are fretting about what they have riding on the game. Patrick Chogle is thinking about wagers too, just not on sports. I don't understand how we can have this quasi-national religion in which everyone in their 9-to-5 jobs, when they should be working, is checking their March Madness bracket, he says. Why is that okay, but a betting market on something as important as a piece of legislation or an election outcome, that is the thing we really police. A 39-year-old lawyer in Northern Virginia, Chogle is one of the country's most outspoken advocates for political betting, a relatively small, definitely growing, questionably legal pastime that is, well, exactly what it sounds like. Just as sports fans wager on the outcome of tennis matches and football games, people like Chogle gamble on who will win electoral races. And that's not all. At Kalshi, an online prediction market, you can wager on which party will control the House after the 2026 midterms, whether President Trump will take over the Panama Canal, or whether Secretary of Health and Human Services Robert F. Kennedy Jr. will drop the federal ban on raw cow's milk. The individual bets can be downright esoteric. Earlier this year, the forecasting platform Manifold was hosting wagers on the Supreme Court's potential overturning of Humphrey's Executor versus the United States, a 1935 case about the president's power to remove the heads of independent federal agencies. Small wonder, then, that the Washington area is home to a passionate political betting community. Politics is the number one sport for the National Capital Region, says John Aristotle Phillips, whose firm, Aristotle, is the Pennsylvania Avenue-based incubator for Predictit, another forecasting platform. You'd be hard-pressed to find people who live inside the Beltway who don't think their political acumen is superior to the average person. It's logical they would put a little skin in the game. Ask a sports gambling enthusiast how they found their way into the activity, and you'll likely hear a story that begins with a big game, favorite team, a group of friends starting a fantasy league, some sort of pathway from enjoying the action to wanting a piece of it. Chogle's road is different. It involves Donald Rumsfeld. Born in East Greenwich, Rhode Island in 1986, Chogle said he was four when he developed his first strongly held political opinion. Iraq had invaded Kuwait, leading to Operation Desert Storm. A relative, Chogle recalls, explained that the U.S. was the schoolyard protector stepping in to fight the bully. That made no sense to Chogle, who went off to Brown University, a committed neoconservative. This was after 9/11, around the same time the U.S. invaded Iraq to topple Saddam Hussein's regime. In college and after, Chogle helped foreign policy figures research their memoirs. Eventually, he worked with Rumsfeld, the former Secretary of Defense who oversaw the Iraq invasion, on his 2012 memoir, Known and Unknown. Chogle had backed that war, largely as an opportunity to promote democracy. But while working on Rumsfeld's book, he was struck by how so much of the good that top officials thought would come from the military intervention, such as Americans being greeted as liberators in the streets of Baghdad, never came close to happening. Meanwhile, some of the country's top foreign policy minds hadn't anticipated the war's catastrophic unintended consequences, such as the rise of the Islamic State. I came to view the Iraq experience, Chogle says, as fundamentally an era of forecasting and prediction. After graduating from Yale Law School, Chogle hopped into politics full-time. In 2016, he joined former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee's presidential campaign as its policy coordinator. In Little Rock, Chogle discovered that domestic politics was as rife with predictive failures as foreign policy. When Huckabee started tanking in the polls, Chogle says, the campaign called a voluntary prayer meeting. I'm thinking, we don't need a prayer session. We need a serious campaign strategy session. Around that time, Chogle discovered a place that valued good predictions, policy betting markets. Betting on politics goes back to the nation's early days. In 1828, future President Martin Van Buren, then a New York politician, urged a friend to wager on the election. Bet on Kentucky, Indiana, and Illinois, he advised. Don't forget to bet all you can. The popularity of the practice is believed to have peaked in 1916 when an estimated $294 million, adjusted for inflation, was wagered in New York's gambling markets on the presidential election, more than was spent on the actual campaigns. By the 1940s, however, political betting tapered off, disrupted by crackdowns on sports gambling, regulations of futures trading, and the rise of professional polling that was seen as a more scientific way of predicting election outcomes. In the 1990s, federal regulators began allowing University of Iowa students and faculty to make trades of as much as $500 on upcoming elections as part of an academic experiment, but otherwise put the kibosh on efforts to create political gambling markets. That changed in 2014, when the D.C. political technology firm Aristotle came across a prediction market platform being run out of New Zealand University and decided to see if it could get American regulators' approval. Predictit was born. Chogle was drawn to the new platform. A poker player since college, he was intrigued by the way competitors think in terms of probabilities. Still working for Huckabee, he thought predicted users were undervaluing a long-shot candidate, Donald Trump. Jogle worked for the Trump campaign in the summer of 2016, but left, he says, amid instability in the operations policy shop. Jogle initially put a few $100s into PredictIt. That grew to a few thousand. Over time, Jogle became a better bettor. He learned to sense when to dip out of especially volatile markets, such as one around the career trajectory of then-FBI Director James Comey. Trump would fire Comey in the spring of 2017, only the second such firing in history. Jogle wasn't alone in finding the markets compelling. Around that time, a pair of 20-somethings went into the famed Y Combinator Tech Incubator with the idea of a prediction markets platform for betting on everything from British soccer to Game of Thrones plot points. They called it Kaushi and won favor from investors for their willingness to go through the effort of trying to get regulators to officially approve it. Their gamble paid off. In 2020, the Commodity Futures Trading Commission approved Kaushi as what's known as a designated contract market. Betting on politics remained off-limits, so in 2023, Kaushi asked regulators to sign off on a market on whether Democrats or Republicans would control Congress. The CFTC balked, and PredictIt was caught up in the fallout, with regulators deciding it had overstepped its limited approval as an academic project focused on political events. As all of this was happening, Jogle concluded that political betting's shaky legal status was downstream of its niche cultural status. The people who make the rules in Washington looked down on the practice and ended up writing rules to codify their disdain. To change that, he reasoned, he would have to do for political wagering what leagues, broadcasters, and paid celebrity endorsers have done for sports wagering. Make it appeal to normies. On a Wednesday night in February, the D.C. Forecasting and Predictions Markets Meetup Network gathers upstairs at the Ugly Mug, a rough-around-the-edges bar on the border of Capitol Hill. Organized by Jogle and D.C. area tech product manager David Glidden, this gathering is part of Jogle's effort to create a bigger political betting community. Jogle's Meetup Network also has chapters in Berlin, Dallas, and New York, as well as planned expansions to San Francisco, London, and Prague. His nonprofit, which began as a research project paid for by a fund promoting so-called effective altruism, is meant to bring together sympathetic academics and others. Then there's his podcast, Star Spangled Gamblers, which was created in 2018 by Alex Keeney, a former congressional staffer turned TV writer. Early on, Keeney, known as Keen Dog in online circles, hosted the podcast with a brotastic edginess familiar to anyone who has consumed sports gambling content. Fellow political betting fans were referred to as Dagans, short for degenerates. I guess it's Degens. One early segment on the falling stock of certain political figures was called Who Needs a Beer? When Keeney left for a job at Politico in 2022, Jogle took over hosting. A lot of the day-to-day churn of the prediction market world, Jogle says, is young men doing what they do in internet forums. A few weeks after meeting up with Jogle at Nanny O'Brien's, I decided to test my own forecasting powers. After depositing a small bit of money into Kaushi, one particular mention market catches my eye. What will White House Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt say in that afternoon's press briefing? I buy three contracts for 50 cents each in favor of Leavitt dropping the name of a Maryland resident deported to El Salvador despite a Supreme Court ruling on the matter. 5 minutes later, score. The media outrage over the deportation of Kilmar Abrego Garcia, Leavitt says, has been nothing short of despicable. My three contracts are now worth $3. Minus transaction fees, I'm up $1.41. I subsequently donate my winnings to the Society of Professional Journalists. The country at the moment arguably stood at the edge of a constitutional crisis. Moreover, a fellow human being's life was at stake. But to me, with less than $2 on the line, it didn't feel like what Cauchy calls trading on the outcome of future events. It felt akin to betting on a Terps Gators, entirely like a game. That's part of what troubles political betting opponents like Senator Jeff Merkley, Democrat from Oregon, who warns against turning elections into rigged gambling casino and has introduced legislation that would ban political betting. In the UK, where political betting is legal and ingrained in the culture, a former lawmaker was among 15 people charged in April with cheating when placing bets on the surprise timing of Britain's 2024 general election, about which they allegedly had insider information. Chogall is sympathetic to concerns that such wagering may weaken public faith in the American democracy. He left the GOP and much of his political career partly because of Trump's insistence that he won the 2020 election and the resulting attacks of January 6. Chogall says that more research on other potential drawbacks is needed. But otherwise, he dismisses the warnings from people like Merkley. Corporations and the ultra-rich using betting to put their thumbs on the electoral scale? Our political system already is awash in cash, he says. Insider trading? Chogall admits that incidents like the UK scandal could erode confidence in the democratic process. But in general, he says, I love that insiders are trading, because if the goal is to surface the most accurate prediction, then the more insider trading you have in these markets, the more accurate, theoretical, the price signal will be. Ultimately, Chogall argues, the UK shows that political gambling and representative government can coexist. They have total free-for-all betting, he says, and I don't think anyone would argue the UK is not a legitimate democracy. For now, the legal landscape for U.S. prediction markets is uncertain, but things appear to be trending in their favor. This winter, Cauchy named Trump's son, Don Jr., as a strategic advisor. The next month, President Trump nominated a Cauchy board member to head the federal agency with regulatory oversight of prediction markets. In May, federal regulators pulled out of a lawsuit that aimed to prevent Cauchy from offering political markets. For Chogall, this creates something of a dilemma. I think Trump's been very destructive in all kinds of ways, but I've never voted for him. And I've never voted for him, he says. But I have to grudgingly concede that on this issue, we're doing pretty well. Will that continue? On Cauchy, there's, surprisingly, no active wagering on the future of prediction markets. This was adapted from an article originally published in Washingtonian. And looks like we've got time for a couple of the Talking Points articles. Circling back to the Epstein files, Maxwell courts a pardon. Ghislaine Maxwell wants to make it clear that the man who could pardon her never did anything wrong, said Dan Friedman and Mother Jones. That's the big takeaway from the newly released transcripts of Jeffrey Epstein Associates prison interviews with Deputy Attorney General Todd Blanche. Now serving a 20-year sentence for sex trafficking minors, Maxwell, 63, told Blanche in July that she never saw President Trump in any inappropriate setting during his 15-year friendship with the pedophile Epstein, and indeed never saw any man act improperly. She called Trump a gentleman in all respects, adding that she admires his extraordinary achievement in becoming president. Blanche, Trump's former personal lawyer, was unusually deferential to Maxwell, said Chris Cameron in the New York Times. He didn't follow up on or challenge the convicted perjurer's statements, even when Maxwell denied recruiting underage girls for sex or claimed that Epstein enjoyed the company of young girls merely because they were up to date on music. The interview was intended to calm the wrath of the president's conspiracy-inclined supporters, said Margaret Sullivan in The Guardian, after the Trump administration refused to honor a campaign pledge to release all the investigative files on Epstein, including a fabled list of the financier's pedophile clients, some MAGA devotees were starting to suspect a cover-up. Enter Maxwell. She hasn't yet received a pardon for her glowing testimony, but a few days after her interview, she was transferred from a low-security Florida prison to a minimum-security one in Texas, known for its arts and crafts programs. That move was a slap in the face to Epstein's hundreds of victims, who remain shamefully low on everyone's list of priorities. The administration, said the relatives of the late Epstein accuser, Virginia Jeffrey, has given Maxwell a platform to rewrite history. Still, Trump will be disappointed if he thinks Maxwell's testimony will make the Epstein issue disappear, said Ankush Kordori in Politico. Top House Republican James Comer, Republican from Kentucky, this week subpoenaed Epstein's estate for the book Maxwell created for the financier for his 50th birthday, which reportedly contains a suggestive note from Trump, along with any record of Epstein clients potentially involved in sex, sex acts, or sex trafficking. Comer's committee is starting to receive subpoenaed Epstein files from the Justice Department, and Jeffrey's memoir, written before her April suicide, hit shelves in October. With roughly half of the country now suspecting Trump of involvement in Epstein's crimes, it will only become harder for the administration to tamp things down. Trump taking over the private sector? Donald Trump is a socialist, apparently, said David M. Drucker in Bloomberg. That's what the Republican Party, circa 2008, which opposed the Obama administration's auto sector bailouts, would have called a president who snared the U.S. government a 10% stake in a struggling chipmaker, Intel, paid for with about $9 billion in grants from the Biden-era CHIPS Act. The deal was made at a White House meeting last week between Trump and Intel CEO Lip-Bu Tan. Notably, Trump had spent days calling for Tan's resignation over his past business dealings with the Chinese military. He walked in wanting to keep his job, said Trump, and he ended up giving us $10 billion for the United States. This is just the beginning, said Ben Berkowitz in Axios. Trump's top economic advisor, Kevin Hassett, said it's absolutely possible the government will take stakes in more U.S. firms. So if you're a CEO, you may soon be invited to sell a chunk of your business to the government, even at the cost of diluting existing shareholders. We've seen a string of rank corporate shakedowns already this year, said Michael Strain in the Financial Times. Trump approved exports of advanced microchips to China by NVIDIA and AMD only after they agreed to hand 15% of their profits to the Treasury and approved the sale of U.S. steel to a Japanese firm only after the government was granted a golden share. The Trump administration says these tactics will bolster U.S. industry so it can better compete with China. But adopting Beijing's state-run capitalist system will mean we also adopt its inefficiencies and corruption, which have led to empty industrial parks, a struggling housing market, weak consumer demand, and deflationary pressure. There are other risks, said Mike Schmidt and Todd Fisher in the Wall Street Journal. If Intel announces layoffs, will Trump get the blame? Will foreign-owned chip makers like South Korea's Samsung, a major player in U.S. manufacturing, be allowed to compete with Intel? Where does this new model of state capitalism stop? It stops once Trump is the dominant authority in all spheres of American life, said Nick Cottagio in the Dispatch. His intel shakedown was motivated by the same desire that led him to send the National Guard into Los Angeles and to Washington, D.C., to impose his will on the Smithsonian and Ivy League universities, and to pardon January 6 rioters. He did it because he could, and it made him look strong. Trump wants to control the means of production and everything else. And a couple short notes on the wind down. For the first time since the 1960s, more immigrants are leaving the U.S. than arriving, according to an analysis of census data by Pew Research Center. The number of foreign-born residents, both legal and undocumented, peaked at 53.3 million in January, but by June had fallen to 51.9 million. The Trump administration plans to lower standards for incoming FBI agents, eliminating a college degree requirement and cutting training at the academy in Quantico, Virginia, from 18 weeks to 8. Agency veterans say the changes will jeopardize the FBI's ability to counter national security threats. And we'll close with a quote or two. Woodrow Wilson says, "I not only use all the brains I have, but all that I can borrow." And Octavia Butler says, "There is no single answer that will solve all of our future problems. There are thousands of answers, at least." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. We hope you have enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information, or if you have comments or questions, please give us a call at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. And as always, thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.